Welcome to the Investment Conversation. I'm Tim Paulson, investment strategist at Lord Abbett. Today we'll be talking about labor markets with Jeff Herzog, managing director and portfolio manager at Lord Abbett.
We've seen the Fed raise rates an incredible amount, and we're still creating jobs and the consumers are still spending. The tricky handoff that investors have to manage this year is the contrast between where we are now and where we may be with these inflation pressures later.
Markets have shifted dramatically over the last several months on a spate of economic good news, but mostly dependent on the idea that the Fed will pivot soon and inflation will be a thing of the past. The idea that there was going to be a soft landing, almost entirely discounted last year, now seems to be almost a market consensus. But this is entirely dependent on the idea that inflation is going to decrease rapidly, be a thing of the past, and really get down to Fed targets soon. And we're certainly seeing signs of this in terms of goods. We've seen Chairman Powell reference the idea of disinflation, but there's one sticking point. Jeff, the labor markets are very tight. We've got now 11 million job openings versus only 6 million job seekers. 20 years ago, 67% of the population was working. Today, 62.3%. You spent a lot of time thinking about inflation and specifically labor market dynamics. And this just seems to me like the real sticking point in this narrative of everything working out well. So I think there's a lot to explore with this topic, but maybe if you could just get your thoughts, first of all, on what is driving this decline in labor force participation. We've never really seen this kind of labor shortfall.
Thanks, Tim. I have been focusing on this issue for exactly what you pointed out, is that it's sort of the linchpin of how we're thinking about the labor force. And there are a lot of different labor force metrics you can look at, but as if someone's, you know, just getting caught up on this subject in a short amount of time, I think this is a great place to start, because U.S. prime age labor force participation has languished for a long time, and that's largely because of males. So let me put a couple numbers on that to give people some perspective. Male prime age participation is at 88.5 today. For other countries, it's more like 92. So the U.S. is underperforming to some extent. And male prime age participation is still a little bit lower than the height it got to pre-COVID. And also, it's been kind of on a trend decline. For prime age women, that same figure for labor force participation is 76%. And again, for other countries, it's more like 83%. And women in the U.S. are actually doing well compared to their own trend, even though they're, you know, underperforming other developed countries. Usually, we use the OECD for that measurement. And economists really debate a number of reasons for why this has happened. Some of these reasons are larger or smaller in effect. And let me take you through a few of those. Here are the major ones. One is technological advancement. You can think of prime age men as traditionally doing stuff with a lot of, you know, physical exertion traditionally, like, you know, go back 50 years or something like that. So men are typically doing heavy stuff. And what's happened is replacement of certain jobs, in particular manual labor, that has been focused more on the type of worker that has attracted, which has been men. And it's kind of interesting because women went through their own kind of automation troubles when in the 70s, you had the clerical workforce really expanding. Women were often selected for that kind of employment. And then you had computing or business automation. And so that started to take away those jobs. So, you know, we tend to focus on the prime male workforce because it's so down from trend, but I wouldn't want to say that nothing's ever happened to prime age women. It's definitely had their share of automation effects.
So real quick, just put some numbers out. So when we say prime age, we're talking like late 20s to 50 or so, early 50s?
Yeah, so it's 24 to 54.
24 to 54. And how much has this declined from pre-pandemic? Because, of course, that's where some of this hiccup goes. Like, we got the trend. And we bemoan the loss of manufacturing jobs and the rest. But as you suggest, there are a lot of other complicating issues. But how much has this just changed since pre-pandemic?
So since pre-pandemic, it depends on what perspective you want to take. Because if you were just to draw a trend line over that history and say, where are we today compared to where we would have expected to be, even if we didn't know COVID was about to happen, we're probably close to that for men. So some of the story here is a resumption of aging effects and other issues that we're about to get into. And other parts of this are obviously effects from the pandemic. And for men, at least, we haven't recouped that labor force participation, probably to the tune of about 0.5%.
So 0.5%, we're talking a couple million people. We still have a larger shortfall than we did. And of course, as you say, we're going to get into that. But so some of this is about prime age workers working less. You mentioned aging effects too.
Yeah. So over time, you know, the demographic structure has changed. And so you have more retirements. And that was one impact of the pandemic, was that it really spurred people to take their retirement early. And that is a clear impact on overall labor force participation. Of course, that's the 55 to 64 bucket. When you look at the other demographic ranges, when you look at the young people 16 to 24, their participation is back to normal. Those people, of course, are at low risk from COVID, so they didn't have, really have that hesitancy to return to work. They also typically have low wage entry level jobs that were in high demand as we had this large reopening been. So young people are doing great, or at least back to normal. Older folks, that 55 to 64 age bracket, we have that persistent drop down in participation, and because of the retirements, and that is a drag on the total labor force participation, the 62% you mentioned right up front in our conversation. And for the prime age workforce, why we focus on that is because we see that as the key productivity generating part of the economy. Like, that goes into all the economic models and the way central banks think about it. And that's where the story gets interesting, because I'm sure there's been some impact from aging in that demographic. There's been sort of a impact from increase in disability usage. Now, that's not as dramatic as, say, automation or aging, but it's still in there. And part of that disability usage may also be related to the rise of the opioid epidemic, and that has typically affected men disproportionately. And so that has impacted their ability to stay in the workforce, and some of them have gone on disability to, you know, work out of any addiction problems. And then we also have more of a focus on training and education. So people are stepping out of the workforce at times to retool. And I'd say that those issues, technology, aging, disability, opioid epidemic, changes in the structured economy, have impacted that trend decline in prime age workforce.
So I've seen numbers, the Fed suggests somewhere around 2 or 3 million in terms of labor shortfall. At the same time, you know, 11 million job openings, 6 million job seekers. Just to get to something that's more consistent with a normal labor market, in theory, we need another 6 or 7 million people in the labor force. So do we have too many job openings? Do we have not enough people looking? Like, how do we make these numbers square up?
So that's kind of the debate, is whether the labor force participation is just something you have to live with, as in it's a structural force and there's nothing the Fed can do about it, right? Should they try to fight against that, or should they try to work with it? You know, in other words, I'm kind of the, it's kind of like the old Donald Rumsfeld thing, you go to war with the army you have. Like, this is the economy you have. You can't like change labor force participation because all these factors are so structural. I mean, there are government policies that might increase it. So for female labor force participation relative to other countries, there's probably some role for, you know, more paternity and maternity leave, expanded childcare, that kind of thing, which sort of creates better connections between those workers and their employer. But I think the Fed just has to look at this situation and think the labor supply isn't as forthcoming, and so the labor market will be tight for a long period of time.
Which is going to create some very interesting dynamics as we think about wage pressures and the feedback into inflation. Maybe another part of this story isn't just the labor force participation rate, but also a decline in hours worked, which may be feeding, you know, one into the other. But you talk a little bit about that phenomenon. Is it all just part of the same trend?
I think that you can make a case for both people reducing hours and people stepping away from the labor force, which is, you know, related to everything we just discussed in terms of secular forces. In terms of people reducing hours, which some people in the media have called like quiet quitting, I think that you have to start with the idea that hours worked hit, you know, about 34.3 a week for the total labor force. And that is basically the lowest level since 2020. Now, you got to split that up into services and goods. So the services sector is basically at a level of hours worked that the level you saw over the past like couple decades. So it's sort of just back to normal. For goods production, because we had all these supply chain problems and there was this unbalanced demand for goods, you saw this huge run up for hours worked. There was probably a shortage of labor, or people were catching up to hire too. So there was probably some overtime. Then, and that's measured separately, but you know, people were probably working double time to try to resolve those supply chain problems. And so goods hours picked up and then came back down, and now they're quite low. And it's interesting because if you take a step back and say, well, how many hours do Americans work compared to other countries? You know, Germany is the lowest. They clock in at 1,350 hours a year, whereas Americans are at about 1,800 hours a year. And so what some people argue is that some of the decline in hours work is sort of America kind of getting closer to where like other developed countries are. But we did get this great study recently by some researchers that really tried to decompose the labor market into, well, is it hours or is it labor force participation? And what they found that amongst male workers, the decline was really larger for those with bachelor degrees. So people with a certain amount of education. And also they tried to sort of sort workers by whether they were high wage or low wage. So they put them into like 10 buckets evenly distributed. And for the highest wage workers, their hours came down the most for today compared to, you know, pre-COVID. So it's sort of like the highest wage workers were getting paid more, and they decided that their hours needed to come down. They sort of recalibrated their work-life balance. And their conclusion was that, you know, since 2020, it's been kind of a both. It's been a reduction in hours, so the quiet quitting phenomenon, and also a reduction in labor force participation. And again, you know, that gets back to what the Fed is trying to see over the long run is, what does this mean for the theoretical long-term rate of growth for the U.S.? And that's how they judge everything, right? So if theoretical long-term rate of growth in the U.S. is low and actual growth is very high, that means that we're sort of growing faster and faster than our natural speed, and that is creating more overheating in the economy. That's like a general principle of how central banks think about the economy.
So on the one hand, then, we've got this, as you say, there's not much the Fed can do about these broader societal trends, fewer people working fewer hours. And I guess they can look at it from the demand side of the economy and say, maybe we need to cool things off to right size the demand for jobs to what's actually available. But a lot of these issues are going to be more on, let's call it the policy front. You know, even immigration, we didn't even talk about that.
But good point.
One word we were hearing a lot, I imagine we'll hear again, you know, banded around at some point is recession. You know, recession is rising unemployment. The Fed has suggested in the past, though, you know, they can just let a little the air out of this overpressurized balloon and just sort of see a small creep up in unemployment. Is that right? Can it work that way? Or is there just too much kind of dispersion among jobs and industries where you have this demand? Can you just relieve some pressure?
Well, you know, relieving some pressure in the housing sector was definitely on the minds of the Fed when they raised rates aggressively. They severely impact housing. That had a drag on the economy, and that's kind of how it works. Like, the Fed raises rates and the most sensitive parts of the economy have trouble. I think at the same time, people were probably focusing a little too much on the rate sensitive parts of the economy. Maybe they weren't right sizing it, because housing is a big part of the economy, but it's not as big as consumption. And as long as you have employment holding up, it's hard for me to say we're in a recession. It's one of the main indicators, a coincident indicator, is how many jobs we're creating. And it's been pretty strong. The unemployment rate is low. And so fundamentally, people still have jobs to pay for stuff. And paying for stuff is a central element of, you know, earning return on bonds, is people servicing their debts and bondholders getting the benefits of those stream of cash flows.
Right.
So I just think that there was probably a little bit too much focus on the dramatic things happening to the rate sensitive parts of the economy. And they were pretty dramatic, but not enough on what were still strong fundamentals, still strong wage gains.
Okay, so we got strong wage gains, as you say, and a lot of the U.S. economy isn't really all that rate sensitive. But at what point do you need to see unemployment rise before it relieves some of these wage pressures? Does the Fed have a view? Do we agree with their view?
That is the remaining open question. So traditionally, you think as a central bank, you want to crush inflation by raising unemployment. You know, there's an unemployment wage trade-off. Another way to think about it is, well, what if we get a lot of productivity? That could be a way to crush inflation. Again, not something that the Fed can control, but certainly could be happening. We don't really know in real time. Another issue could be that the secular forces from before are really, you know, kicking in hard. And maybe we're getting back to a level of wages that's, you know, not particularly, it's definitely higher than what we experienced in the 5 years before pre-COVID, when they were certainly very muted, but at the same time, not so high as to threaten inflation expectations. And that's sort of the way you might get a soft landing, is inflation expectations stay muted and wage pressures, while elevated, aren't so scary as to threaten a more systemic inflation issue.
Perhaps you just see an erosion of record high margins or something along those lines.
And that's an excellent point as well. There's been a lot of focus by the Fed as well on margins, and if, you know, companies have the profits to pass that on to workers or not.
Is there some extent to which this tight labor market may mitigate the severity of a recession?
I think when you think of the labor market as causing some repair in household balance sheets, it depends on your starting point. We happen to be coming from a situation where, you know, the consumer wasn't over their skis levered, and now jobs are plentiful and they've been able to right size their household wealth because of what had been an increase in home prices up till recently. So I think that suggests some resiliency in the labor market, in the economy. And that's what we've seen. We've seen the Fed raise rates an incredible amount, and we're still creating jobs, and consumers are still spending. I think, in my mind, when I think of what creates a worse recession, it's usually some liquidity event or systemic issue within the financial system. It's possible that the rate sensitivity of the economy is lurking somewhere that we haven't discovered yet, and that could be it. But yeah, if you're asking me, you know, are consumers amped up on sketchy loans or crazy, you know, auto loans and all that, I don't think it's there this time around. I think the vulnerability we have to look for in some other part of the economy.
Well, and certainly our look at our asset-backed securities team focus a lot on the consumer. Their data agrees with you. Personally, I've always been amused at the wailing and gnashing of teeth at, oh, there's too much consumer debt and this is terrible. And then as soon as rates go higher, and oh no, you're raising and it's gonna make it hard for people to borrow. And I think there's just certainly a tendency in the media to just give us the negative side of things whenever possible. But we do have this trade-off that we've got a lot of debt. We want people to borrow. We want them to spend. Press conference with Powell, people ask about financial conditions. You know, hey, people feel great. Financial conditions are easing. Is this okay, or does this possibly contribute to inflationary pressures?
This is what I'm worried about, is a reacceleration of the economy. So the Fed backs off a little bit because it's moved a lot, and it sees, you know, positive trends in wages, positive trends in inflation, and it doesn't want to overdo it, which I understand. This isn't rocket science, no matter how many PhDs the Fed try to convince you it is, right? We're feeling through. So the Fed kind of takes a pause. Financial conditions loosen, the economy reaccelerates, but we're still growing above potential growth, maybe, or the labor market still keeps printing 200,000 jobs a month. I mean, we'll have to see. But with high job openings, very low initial jobless claims, which indicate that people aren't losing jobs or there's not a lot of reduction in payrolls, I think the threat is still there. The question is the extent of it. And for now, the market is leaning more into the this isn't going to be so bad thesis.
And as you highlighted earlier, there are some ways out of this. Productivity gains, for example, certainly we had a startling plunge in productivity, at least the way the data shows it over the summer, but that's been recovering. But again, a lot of this is predicated on, can we ultimately provide enough labor here in the U.S. to fulfill some kind of trend growth? What should we be watching for in terms of labor market dynamic? I mean, I'll frame it a different way. Markets are priced for good news, but there's still a lot of uncertainty ahead. We will get more information over the coming months that give us some more insight into how this is playing out. What should investors be focused on? What do you think is going to, what are some of the key metrics?
I'd say, aside from the ones we've already mentioned, there's one under the radar weekly indicator I like a lot by the Census Bureau. They produce business formations, and they have different categories of that. But the main idea is that you're applying to form a business and you're creating jobs. So there's some very long-term lead lag relationship between that indicator and job growth. I like to look at it as a range, you know, like compare the level of business formations that we're running at this time of year compared to the range over the past 5 years. It's sort of like how people in commodities look at inventories at this point in the time. They look at, you know, how is that over the previous range. So we're still running at high business inventories. And I'd like to see that slow down if I wanted to be more confident about a more easy pace of growth. And that pace of growth we're looking for is about 100K. Some people say 50 to 100K. So there's maybe a range you could play with there. But the pace of job growth that is a more stable unemployment rate is less than what we're at right now. And that's another indicator to watch.
Pay attention to total job formation and leading indicators of job formation and productivity, you know, how much are we getting for each person working. But as I said, still a lot of uncertainty over the short to medium term, maybe even the long term. What should investors be thinking about? I mean, okay, we can watch some of these indicators, but I feel like the investing public has been buffeted around, you know, the world's going to end. No, everything's great. How does an investor position themselves with this kind of uncertainty out there?
Yeah, I think this year is deceptively tricky because I know many asset classes did badly in 2022. So in some sense, maybe people are expecting a little relief in that it can't be possibly that bad again. Or maybe people were actually expecting like us to go headfirst into recession. So I think one thing is that because we're not in recession, you have to have some risk on. The question is, do you want to be, you know, at your maximum band, you know, or maximum risk tolerance? And I still shy away from that because there is this late cycle environment from the threat of wages being high and the Fed having to do something about it. And at the same time, I don't think you should be completely in your bunker of risk because, you know, people are going out and spending, people have jobs. So that is the tricky handoff that investors have to manage this year is the contrast between where we are now and where we may be with these inflation pressures later. And so, you know, we've been advocating, you know, not being extreme in your positions, but also making sure that you have, you know, high quality carry, that you're taking risk in appropriate, resilient sectors of fixed income and equities.
I think with that, Jeff, I'd like to thank you a lot. I think your work here is done. It's always enjoyable and informative speaking with you. I'd like to remind everyone listening today that Jeff's commentary on the economy and Fed policy and markets is regularly featured on lordabbott.com. And if you'd like a transcript of today's podcast or have any other questions on topics covered today, please contact your Lord Abbott representatives. Finally, we'd like to open the platform to you. If you have any comments about today's session or any suggestions for future topics, drop us a line at podcasts@lordabbott.com.
Special thanks to Lord Abbott Senior Editorial Strategist Will Andrews for assistance with this episode. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite streaming app of choice. The U.S. Federal Reserve is the central bank of the United States. The federal funds, or Fed funds rate, is the target interest rate set by the Fed at which commercial banks borrow and lend their excess reserves to each other overnight.
Gross domestic product, or GDP, is the monetary value of all finished goods and services produced within a country's borders in a specific time period, though GDP is usually calculated on an annual basis. It includes all private and public consumption, government outlays, investments, and exports, less imports, that occur within a defined territory.
Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to, securities of those companies.
Unless otherwise noted,
All discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott Speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market conditions or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott Speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered.
None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity.